If I was going to ask you, what would be the top five Old Testament Bible stories that you love to tell to children, what would be in there? You've got 20 seconds. Ask the person next to you, 20 seconds. What do you think are crackers, absolute crackers? Okay, I'm stopping you there. I Googled it. I Googled it this week, and there was a website which had what they thought were the most popular, and they were these. Firstly, do they match up with yours? Creation. Then Noah's flood. Then David and Goliath. Then the fiery furnace with Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego. And then finally, Daniel and the lion's den. What made it into yours, Jonah? Balaam and his donkey. Joseph and his technicolored dream coat. What about Dagon? What about Dagon? That's what we're looking at today. I remember growing up and in the Brethren, the Gospel Hall Church I grew up in, and Sunday school always used to be very exciting because the teachers would get, they used to tell the stories very well. They used to bring them to life very well, and you'd be in fits of giggles as you heard some of the stories. And do you know what? That's partly what they are there to do. Right, these stories we are looking at today would have been told around the campfire by God's people as they passed on from generation to generation the amazing works that God had done. They're meant to live. They're meant to breathe. And I just wonder, as we've been going through 1 Samuel, have you been telling your kids the stories? You should do, because they just keep getting better and better and better. They talk about our glorious God and his plan to save, and they are rich and rich. So maybe your grandchildren or your children or your nephews or nieces, before bedtime, have a go at letting them rip, because they really do rip. And today is another one of those. You see, there is real joy in chapters 5 and 6, but to feel the joy, we need to go back to chapter 4. And what we heard last week, if you weren't here last week, we're just going to see a little bit again the horror of what we faced. You see, God's honor last week was dirtied. It was dirtied. God's people are defeated in an emphatic and miserable way, much like the way the Welsh team on Friday were defeated against the All Blacks. You can tell I wrote this sermon on Friday rather than Saturday night, because I might have brought up another defeat, which I'll leave because you're still smarting. But at the start of chapter 4, things look rosy. There was an initial mini defeat. And they said, it's all right, we're going to get God on board. Chapter 4, verse 3, have a look at it. When the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel said, why did the Philistines bring defeat on us today before the Philistines? Why did the Lord bring defeat on us today before the Philistines? Let us bring out the ark of the Lord's covenant from God so that he may go with us and save us from the hand of the enemies. He says, look, we're going to bring God on our side. And they had the ark of the covenant. If you remember, it looked a little bit like this. And verse 4, look at it. So the people sent the men to Shiloh, and they brought back the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, who is enthroned between the cherubim. Now, this is really important. What does he tell us about the Ark of the Covenant of God? God is enthroned between the cherubim. It's those two angels there. It is a picture that God is with them. What happens to the box is what happens to God. And they bring God, represented by this box, into the battle. And look at how they respond in verse 5. What do they do? When the Ark of the Lord's covenant came into camp, all Israel raised such a shout that the ground shook. Forget walking past Carroll Road when the canaries score. The ark comes in and they go mad. Why? No one can beat them. Not when they've got God on their side. They've got the art there now. No one's going to beat them. They're unbeatable. They'd have been writing about it in the paper all week beforehand, saying, if you had a coach like our coach, if you just won a victory like our victory, there's no way we could be defeated. They think they are definitely going to win. And look, the Philistines, they think they're definitely going to lose. Do you see it? Look back. Look back at verse 6b. When they learned that the ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. A God has come into their camp. They said, oh no, nothing like this has happened before. We're doomed. Who's going to deliver us from the hand of the mighty God? They are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. They're like, we are finished. It's all over. We are definitely going to lose. Israel think we're going to win. The Philistines say, we are definitely going to lose. We are doomed. And what do you expect is going to happen? Israel get smashed. The leaders are murdered. And the ark gets taken into Philistine territory. And God's honor and name is dragged through the dirt. You know, if you've been reading the Bible for any length of time, you will know the Philistines are always the bad guys. You know, they are, it's a bit like when you read the New Testament, you know you're meant to boo the Pharisees. And we know we are meant to boo the Philistines. They are the enemies of God's people. They are the Philistines. And they feel like pantomime villains. When we read this, we realize they are not just pantomime villains. There's nothing pantomime about their violence in chapter 4, verse 10. Just look at it. The Philistines fought and the Israelites were defeated and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers, 30,000 husbands, 30,000 dads and brothers and grandsons and uncles, never to come home to their family again. The Philistines were ferocious army enemies who hated God and hated his people. And chapter 4 is utterly depressing. But as we know from 1 Samuel, God is the God of reversals. And he is a God who can turn even the most embarrassing, humiliating defeat into the most glorious of victories. See, in chapter 4, his name is dirty, but in chapter 5, his honor is displayed. It's displayed in a number of delicious ways. Look what happens to Dagon. Dagon is down. Can you imagine the Philistines walking back from that victory? What would they have been doing? I think they would have been singing a song. I think they would have been saying, well, those Egyptians aren't all that hard, are they? Look at us. We took them down. Easy, easy, easy. Look at 5 verse 1. What do they do? The Philistines had captured the ark of God. They took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. They carried the ark into the Dagon's temple and set it beside Dagon. Dagon is one of their big players. He's part of the pantheon of gods, but if you like, he is one of the ultimate gods that they have. Lots of you will have thought of him as like the merman, the fish god, but more recent archaeological evidence point him to being a god of fertility, a god of crops. They believed in lots of gods, but he was the top dog. And as they put the Ark of the Covenant before Dagon, they are saying, look, Dagon, what you have done. You've just smashed the God of Israel. I imagine they went to bed that night. The Philistines, having drunk a few pints, feeling very merry and feeling very pleased with themselves. And as they wake up the next morning with a bit of a hangover, they find they're not the only one with a hangover. Verse 3, when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. And so what do they do? They think, well, what happened? What happened with Dagon? Okay, I think maybe he had a few himself. And so let's get him back up. Let's put him back up. He's the victor. There must have been a tremor or something. Let's get him back in his position. He may be face down before the Ark of the Covenant, but he's not the one who's lost here. And so they put him back up. And then morning two, what happens to Dagon? Verse four, the following morning they rose, and there is Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. His head and his hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Philistines, here is your God, little g. Here is your God. He's your best one. And he's headless. He can't think. He can't speak. You know, I wonder if it's the last time we'll meet a giant from Philistine whose head will be lopped off. See, God is wanting to show Israel and the world what Hannah says is true. Do you remember Hannah's prayer is the key to unlocking 1 Samuel? Just look back. 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 2. What does she say? There is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. You know, Dagon is, we read chapter 5, and Dagon is such an impressive God. He's so amazing, right, that the priests are buying shares in super glue because they're having to use so much of it to put him back together. See, God here is wanting Israel to know that they really do serve the one true God. But they don't. He doesn't just want them to know. He wants them to know that they know. See, there's a little detail in verse 5. I don't know whether you saw it. It's one of those things that you can just read over and not read too much into. But look at verse 5. That is why, to this day, neither the priests of Dagon nor any others who enter Dagon's temple at Ashdod step on the threshold. Just imagine when this is written, and the people who are initially reading it, they would go, oh yeah, that's right. To this day, neither the priests of Dagon nor any others enter the Dagon's temple, step on the threshold. They go like, oh yeah, that's right. Do you remember when we went on holiday last year to Philistine territory? Now obviously they wouldn't, because the Philistines wanted to kill them. But just imagine they did. And they go to the temple at Ashdod, and they see the little plaque there, which says, do not step on the threshold. And they say, you know that little plaque? That's why. That's why the God they worship, his head was flattered. He was decapitated and his head was on the threshold. You know, when you go there, and it's kind of comical because the priests are prancing around, jumping over the threshold because they can't walk on it. You know when that happens? Do you know what it says to you? There's no one like our God. See, he wants them to know that they can know that in history, there's no one like their God. There's no one else to fear. You know, I don't know if you've ever done that game. I feel like it's a game that's like a bullying game. In a youth group, I mean, maybe if you've ever done it here, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But you take an individual out of the room and you say, look, we've got an obstacle course in the room. We're going to blindfold you. And we're going to give you instructions when you come into the room to get over the obstacles. And they come into the room and you're giving them instructions. Jump ahead. Turn left. Oh, slow down. And actually, there's nothing in the room at all. They're just looking silly as they are stepping over all these things that aren't actually there. what's happening with the priests here in Ashdod. The very fact that Dagon's head was there proves there is nothing holy about him at all. And yet they're living in fantasy land. You know, what are the idols that Israel feared? Who are the gods that Israel feared? And I wonder, who are the other gods that we fear? Who are the gods in our culture that we think, oh, we can't step there because it's holy ground? And they say we can't step there because it's holy ground, when the Bible is very clear that there is no other God and we really can step there because this is God's world. You know, what are the idols of our age? What are the issues in our culture? They say, oh, no, you have to jump over that. What are you talking about? There are no God other than our God. Well, the God they worship has no power. The God they worship and the gods people worship today are stuck together with super glue. Dagon is down. And it's not just Dagon who's down. The Philistines pop it. Did you see that in verses 6 to 12? Wherever the Ark of the Covenant is, destruction flows. This box that is meant to be their trophy is toxic. Have a look at verse 6. The Lord's hand was heavy on the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation on them and afflicted them with tumors. And look what happens in verse 9 when the ark goes somewhere else. The city, both young and old, with an outbreak of tumors. And have a look at verse 12 where it goes somewhere else. Those who did not die were afflicted with tumors. And the outcry of the city went up to heaven. These cities cannot get rid of the ark quick enough. Ashdod, and then it bounces up to Gath, over to Gath, and then the rats are spilling all over the streets and balls of tumors are everywhere. And so they throw the hospital pass to Ekron, and I love the welcoming party of the ark as it gets to Ekron. Listen to how excited they are as they receive this gift of the ark. Look at verse 10b. As the ark of God was entering Ekron, can you imagine it? It's coming into the town. And the people's mouths drop as they all flood onto the streets. And they look on as this ark comes in and they cry out, they've brought the ark of God of Israel round to kill us and our people. 11b, send the ark of God of Israel away. Let it go back to its own place or it will kill us and our people. See, here's the difference between Dagon and the Lord Almighty. Dagon has no hands. He's handless. They're there on the floor. Whereas God's hand is active and powerful. Look what we're told, verse 6. The Lord's hand is heavy. Verse 9, the Lord's hand is against the city. Verse 11, the Lord's hand is heavy on the city. They cannot handle the hand of God, because they can't handle the holiness of God. When Hannah says in 2 verse 2, there's no one holy like our God. When sinful, rebellious, idolatrous, unforgiven people come into contact with a holy God, a God who cannot tolerate sin, his justice is unleashed, and there can only be one result: death and destruction. In 11b, we're told that death had filled the city with panic, and this idea of panic, this word, when used elsewhere in the Old Testament, it is used in the context of being at war and in a battle where the army is routing them and they are in panic. And here there is no army. There's just the presence of a holy God. See, in chapter 4, God's honor is dirtied. But in chapter 5, God's honor is displayed. And in chapter 6, we see God's honor demonstrated. He wants to prove to them that this really was him. See, in chapter 6, there is a question that is going around the Philistines. You know, they've got the five rulers of the five main cities together, and they're aware that there is all this destruction happening, and they think it is to do with the ark. They are pretty confident it is to do with the ark of God, but they are not absolutely certain. Have a look at 6 verse 1. When the ark of the Lord had been in the Philistine territory for 7 months. And now they're thinking, is it to do with him? As they're piling up the body bags. And verse 6, what are we told about them? This is what the priests say to the rulers. Why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaohs did when God dealt harshly with them? There seems to be a bit of reticence. Oh, we think it's to do with the ark, but maybe it isn't. Maybe it's just a coincidence. And again, have a look at verse 9. They set up a test. And what is the result of this test? End of verse 9. But if it does not, then we shall know that it was not his hand that struck us, but it happened to us by chance. They're clearly thinking, is this the God of Israel or not? And so they decide to send the ark back. And the priests have the wisdom. Verse 3, they say, if you return the ark of God, do not send it back without a gift. By all means, send a guilt offering to him. Then you will be healed, and you will know why his hand has not been lifted from you. So they say, you know, send the ark, send a guilt offering. What's the guilt offering? Verse 4, 5 gold tumors, 5 gold rats, according to the number of Philistine rulers, because of the same plague has struck both you and your rulers. So it's the idea that they kind of make these gold would have been the most valuable metal, pretty similar today, isn't it? And they say, take the most valuable thing, craft it like the judgment you have faced, send it back, but here is the test, and it's the cow test. It's the cow test. Verse 7, what are they to do? Here's the cow test. Get a new cart ready with 2 cows that have calved and have never been yoked. Hitch the cows to the cart, but take their calves away and pen them up. Then take the ark and put of the Lord and put it on the cart in the chest beside it, and put the gold objects you are sending back to him as a guilt offering. Send it on its way. So what they are doing, they are setting up this cart with all the important objects, and they are saying, we're going to do everything we can to give this cart a almost impossible chance of going back to Israel. Okay, so firstly, they are not leading it. They're not, someone's not going to, with a stick, keep the cows in line to make sure it goes to Israel. No, they are freewheeling. Secondly, these cows in verse 7 have never been yoked. What does that mean? The first time they have this stuff put on their shoulders, what are they going to do? Any normal cow would buckaroo. And the third thing about these cows is they've recently had babies. And mummy cows hate to be separated from their baby cows. And they said, right, we're going to take your little baby cows and we're going to stick them over here in a pen, and they're going to be crying, mooing, where's mummy, where's mummy, in their mooing language. And mummy's going to be there going, I want to be near my kids. And we're going to put those cows on sending the Ark of the Covenant back to Israel. No chance. They're not going to make it because they're going to want to go back to their mummies. And so they set it all up and they put the cows on and they say, right, here we go. Was it really the God of Israel? Look at verse 12. Then the cows went straight up towards Beth Shemesh. It's like a bullet train. Keeping on the road, lowing all the way. They did not turn to the right or the left. And the rulers of the Philistines followed them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. This language of them lowing, they're not happy. It's not them mooing in a, we're really happy we're going this way. It's them going, oh, we don't want to go this way, in their cow language. Because they want to be with their kids, but they can't stop themselves. There's something supernatural as they go and they go and they go to Beth Shemesh. And as they arrive in Beth Shemesh, the people are absolutely stoked. They are They are filled with joy. The Ark of the Covenant is back. But look at verse 16. The five rulers of the Philistines saw all this, and then they returned that same day to Ekron. See, what is God doing here? He is demonstrating to the Philistines that you cannot mess with the Lord Almighty. There is no one holy like our God. In fact, all the way through this passage, I don't know whether you noticed, there's loads of allusions to the Exodus. All the way through the text, the way that God rescued his people from Egypt, there's like a mini Exodus going on here. 4 verse 8, what are they saying? In the start, in the fight, what are they saying? Do you remember this? They're saying they are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. And then in chapter 5, we like have these plagues engulfing the land. And then in chapter 6, verse 6, what happens? They say, why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaohs did? There are loads of things in here which are kind of like references back to the Exodus. It's like a mini picture of that. And what was the point of what God was doing in the Exodus? Exodus 7, verse 5. Listen to this. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my what? My hand. Against Egypt. And bring the Israelites out of it. Yes. Yes. Philistines, I am the God of Israel who rescued them from Egypt. And you may have won that battle. That's because I had other purposes for that. But what you've got to understand is there is no God like me. Three big things from this section for us today. And I think one of the big things is this. You can know that you know there is no one like the Lord. You know, we saw that in 5 verse 5, but look, there's another moment. Like it in 6 verse 17 and 18. Look at it. It's a it's the person who's written this down, it's an editorial comment, like 5 verse 5 was. Look at it. 6 verse 17. These are the gold tumors the Philistines sent as guilt offering to the Lord. One each for Ashdod, Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron, these key towns. And the number of gold rats, according to the number of Philistine towns belonging to the five rulers, the fortified towns with the country villages, the large rock on which the Levites set the Ark of the Lord, is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. What's he saying here? He's saying, as they tell this story around the campfire and the kids are going, did God really do that? They can say, yeah, let's go up to the museum. We can have a look at those five gold rats. We can have a look at those five gold tumors. In fact, we can get our hiking gear on and we can go to that rock at Beth Shemesh where the cart came and they offered the sacrifice. It's all there. It's all real history. God really did act like this. You can trust him. The decapitated Dagon, the rat-infested rose, the missile precision cows. You can know that you know it's real history. Now, I'm aware that you're sat there going, well, Andy, where are the gold rats today? And they're probably waiting for some archaeological dig somewhere. We'll find them. Or maybe they got melted down. Who knows? I'll tell you what, you can go to the British Museum and you can see mountains of evidence that backs up the historicity of the Old Testament. It's there. And actually, where do we look? Well, we don't look to golden rats and golden tumors. Where do we look in history for God's greatest victory? An empty tomb. Real evidence, real events, real history. You can know that you know that there's no one like the Lord. But also he wants you to know this. We could be thankful. God doesn't need you to achieve his plans. What is one of the weirdest things about these three chapters? Samuel's disappeared. Right, if you've been here following the series, the first four chapters, the first three chapters of 1 Samuel, there's a miracle baby, and Eli and Hophni and Phinehas are disasters, and here's the boy who's going to raise up, and he's going to lead God's people. Where's Samuel gone? He's totally disappeared, and yet God's plans are not unhindered. God doesn't need us. There's a children's song. I don't know if you've ever sung it. It goes like this. God has no hands, but our hands to do his work today. He has no feet, but our feet to lead others in his way. It's a children's song that says, honestly, if it wasn't for you and your super glue, no one's going to get saved. Everything is lost. If it's not for you and your hands, God is totally impotent. How far from the truth of this passage is that? Here is God, away from his people, creating what is one of the greatest victories you'll find in 1 Samuel. He doesn't need us to achieve his purposes, and so there is something that we can be thankful about. You know, if you serve in a way that makes you think, if I don't do this, if it isn't for me doing this, then God's will is not going to be achieved. It's all down to me. Then you are living in a fantasy world where you are worshiping Dagon. Our God doesn't need us, but he does graciously choose to use us. He uses us so that people will know his name. But he doesn't need us, so we can relax. There's one final thing. And the final thing is this. God is holy. Be wary. See, this passage could leave us thinking, yeah, of course God's enemies cannot handle being near a holy God. But there is a sting in the tail. Have a look at verse 19. We didn't read it on purpose. The ark turns up. It's in God's territory. It's with God's people. And look at verse 19. But God struck down some of the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, putting 70 of them to death because they looked into the ark of the Lord. The people mourned because the heavy blow of the Lord had dealt them. And the people of Beth Shemesh asked, who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? To whom will the ark go from here? You see, yes, God cannot tolerate sin, not just of the world, but of us. For a sinful person to stand in the presence of a holy, righteous God, well, it's easier for an astronaut to try landing on the surface of the sun. See, this passage is a great victory, but it is sobering. A week Friday ago, we were in Worthing on holiday, and my brother was staying for a couple of days, and they babysat, and Grace and I went off for a walk in Worthing. It's on the coast, on the south coast. And the wind was up, and the waves were spectacular. They were just huge and ferocious. And we were stood on the pier looking down in awe. We were in awe of them. They were just majestic. And yet also there was tinged with fear. What if we fell in? We wouldn't stand a chance. The rip curve. The power of it. We would not stand a chance. See, 1 Samuel 5 and 6 says, look at your God in awe, in his majesty, in his holiness. He will beat all his enemies. You can be certain of it. But make sure you are not one of his enemies. See, the only way we cannot be one of his enemies is the gospel ark of this story. You see, this is not the first time and it's not the last time that God looks like he is defeated and then rises up to victory. See, as we look back to the one whose honor was dirtied on the cross as he died in humiliation and yet 3 days later was raised in honor to display and demonstrate that he is the one who can forgive us of our sin. How else can anyone stand in before a holy God other than trusting in his forgiveness, in his death, in his resurrection life? May he be alone our hope. Let's bow our heads. I'll just give you a few moments to say to the Lord what you want to say in your heart. Respond to him. There is no one holy like the Lord. There's no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. Father God, we pray that as your people we might both marvel in awe at your holiness. We might rejoice that all your enemies will one day bow the knee. There is no God like you. Father, we want to say sorry for all those times that we have clung to our own idols, the things that we put in place of you, and live for. Sorry for all the times where we thought they are more important than you, and sorry for all the times that we have not considered the seriousness of your holiness and the horrific nature of our sin. Again, we cling to Christ and his victory. May we be a people who proclaim and trust him alone. In Jesus' name, amen.